This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
What I'm going to talk about this evening is how does someone become a doctor and what is life as a medical student like and what's that sort of progress. What I'm not going to cover tonight is really the day-to-day of what happens with medical students, because you're actually going to hear from our vice dean, Catherine Lucy, later on in the series about the new curriculum, because we've just launched a year and a half ago a new curriculum that we're quite proud of. So I'm going to jump in. A couple of caveats. One is if I lapse into sort of medical education babble or physician babble, please interrupt me and ask me if there's something I've said that doesn't make sense. I'm totally fine with being interrupted. I guess I should say, so I'm a physician. I am an emergency room and consultation liaison psychiatrist by training. So I do some transplant work around liver and bone marrow, and then do mostly emergency room work. But now I'm an administrator, mostly being in the dean's office. So I'm just going to quickly run through what are the basic four sequencings of how someone becomes a physician. I'm going to go back and go into detail of what happens with each of these. So pre-med is, and you've all heard about the rigors of pre-med, and we have required courses for someone from college to become eligible to apply for medical school, and I'll show you what those are. But basically, they required courses in biology, physics, English, chemistry, and then they have to take something called the Medical College Admission Test. It's called the MCAT. It's given about 18 times a year, I think, and it's the test in the United States that has professional tests that has the most takers. It's upwards of 50,000 exams are given every year for medical schools. And just to give you an idea, there's now 146 medical schools in the United States, another 17 or 19, I believe, in Canada. They're all governed by the Association of American Medical Colleges. And the class size for those schools ranges from 40 up to over 300. Those are for what's called allopathic medical schools, where you get an MD. There's also many other DO, osteopathic schools, that have very similar training. The average number of graduates each year in the United States from medical schools is somewhere between around 25,000 per class. So there's a lot of people graduating from those 146 schools. The other thing that many schools are doing is something called holistic review, looking at really balancing three parts of an applicant's strengths. Most people recognize the academics because that's what's traditionally been done, looking at the MCAT score and the GPA as an undergraduate. To that, we've been adding experiences and attributes. I'm going to go into that in just a moment. So that's the first phase, is someone goes to college, decides to be pre-med, and that, unfortunately, is also the place where a lot of people drop out of becoming physicians. There's a couple of courses. The biggest one that are considered sort of barriers to get across. And within chemistry, there's something called organic chemistry that is particularly difficult. And that tends to be the thing in college that people makes or breaks people going into medical school. The next phase is medical school, and it's 4 years. There are some new three-year medical schools popping up. UC Davis, which is where I came from a year ago, is a traditional four-year medical school. However, can do it in 3 years. They are one of, I think now, 9 schools across the country that have innovative programs where you can go there. And when you get accepted to medical school, it's 3 years of medical school, and you're guaranteed 3 years of residency in internal medicine. Most schools are 4 years. Ours is a 4-year school. And the reason there's a plus there is because you can do joint degrees. So probably the most well-known one here is the MD PhD program, and that tends to be between 7 and 9 years long, depending on how long the PhD goes. But most people do 4. What's very interesting and unique about UCSF is that within that 4 years, just under half the class, so somewhere between 40 and 45% of people actually take 5 years to graduate from UCSF. And that's typically because they will either do another degree, do a research year, do some sort of international service kind of thing. So, and that's at the upper limits of what most medical schools do. Other medical schools will not allow people to do quite that many people to do that long. We do have an interesting rule, though, and it's sort of universal across the United States, is we really want you, unless you're in an extended degree program, like a PhD or getting a JD or an MBA or an MPH, we want you to finish in 6 years. So we have a six-year rule that unless you're doing one of those things, we really want you to finish, just because there's timing with some of the exams, licensing exams, that are required for that. Throughout medical school, there's lots of different kinds of learning. This is actually one of the lecture halls that we use sometimes. There's classroom, there's clinical and community experiences. One of the things that's new about the curriculum here and across the new curricula across the country is students are getting exposed to clinical work a lot earlier. It used to be that you were sitting in a lecture hall for the first year and a half or 2 years, and then you got introduced to patients. I actually went to medical school at Columbia in New York City back in the 80s, a while ago, and we didn't see or touch a patient until our third year. We actually now here at UCSF and most schools introduce people to patients in the fall of their first year, freshman year. With some training. The education covers science, problem solving, communication skills, preventative care, professionalism, and medical ethics. And those last two have really been added and emphasized over the last couple of decades. Some very interesting research was done actually here at UCSF. The person whom I replaced, Maxine Papadakis, had been the student affairs dean for 17 years, and she published some very interesting data looking back to, I believe, 1949, looking at what kinds of things people later got in trouble for with the medical board. Were there any predictive values in the undergraduate medical education years? And it became evident that professionalism and medical ethics was one of the things that we needed to address. Because she actually discovered that things that seemed as simple as someone missing deadlines for vaccinations was actually predictive of them running into trouble with the medical board as a practicing physician. So we started paying attention to that quite early on. Our curricula are updated pretty regularly. As I said, we just launched a new one called Bridges that changes things up quite a bit, and it really pulls in new innovations in science, new innovations in how to learn how to think about things. We have something called the inquiry curriculum, as well as microsystems, so teaching people about systems and healthcare systems, as well as being very interprofessional. So learning very early on how to work with nursing staff and physical therapists and the range of people that are healthcare givers. And we really have four areas that people focus on. The ones that people know of are clinical care. Obviously, we're a healthcare system. We give care. Research. And UCSF has the pleasure, I believe, of being the medical school in the country that has the highest NIH funding. But we also are obviously educational. We have the graduate school, the dental school, nursing school, medical school, and I'm leaving one out that I'm going to be embarrassed that I can't remember. So we address education. The last one, and I added here because this is from the Association of American Medical Colleges, is service. So we really look at service as well to the community and as well as around the world. What happens at your last year of medical school is something called the match, and you've probably heard about that. It's the goal, in addition to learning about how to become a good physician, regardless of what field you're going to go into, is to ultimately pick a specialty, go into a residency, and the match, and I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about it in a little bit, is how that's done. Suffice it to say, it's not like the normal job interview process where you go and you interview and you get multiple offers. You go and you interview, and it's all run through a computer, and on match day, which is the third Friday in March, all 25,000 graduating seniors find out at the exact same time, noon on the East Coast, 9 a.m. here, some ridiculous hour in Hawaii probably, you hear 25,000 envelopes being opened with the one place that they're going to be, where they're going to go, where they've matched. So that's why it's called the match, because you've given the one place that you've matched to. The next phase after that is after you match, you go on to residency. And residencies, at last count, there are over 160 kinds of residencies and fellowships you can do. And it's hands-on training. It's supervised. You actually need to complete an internship to be licensed in all 50 states. And you've probably heard the term internship and residency. And it used to be in the old days that everyone did what was called a rotating internship, where you did some medicine, some peds, some surgery, some OBGYN. Residencies have now incorporated that into their residencies. So if you do a pediatrics residency, you do 3 years of peds, and the first year is still called an internship, but you're doing only peds. There are some residencies that require you to do a rotating kind of thing, and those anesthesia and neurology, radiology, there's several of those programs, and if we have some time, I'll get into a little bit of that. The hallmark of residency is hands-on, but given... Please. No. Sorry, I'm glad you asked the question. So the way they're set up now is if you go into internal medicine or surgery, they're both internal medicine is 3 years, surgery is 5 years. You do general surgery all 5 years. And it used to be that internship, which is sort of now part of residency, it used to be a separate part. So you hear people talking, you hear people talking about interns, and it used to be the interns did everything in the hospitals. So if you watch movies from the 60s and 50s and 40s, you'll see interns that are living in the hospital, right? And they did a little bit of everything, and they went on to specialize. What's happened over time is instead of having people going off and doing 1 year and then focusing on their specialty, they now include the internship in the residency. So when you hear someone saying, I'm a pediatric intern, that means they're in a three-year residency, but they just happen to be in the first year. So it's an artifact of what used to be historically different, but now an intern is just a first-year resident. They don't, no. So what happens is once you're now in a residency, you will rotate within that residency. So if you're in internal medicine, you will do some intensive care unit work. You will do some electives, perhaps in cardiology or nephrology, and you do that over the 3 years, but you're doing all internal medicine. There is time for electives in most residencies in either the second or third year if it's a three-year residency. Psychiatry is a four-year residency, and you can then go and do some other things, but you don't really leave your specialty even for that. Does that make sense? Thank you for asking that. Any other questions? So what happens now, as I said, there's all these specialties that one can go into. So what happens is people go into a residency, and you stick with internal medicine. You do general internal medicine, it's 3 years, but to become a specialist in a subspecialty of medicine, so cardiology, rheumatology, nephrology, intensive care unit, you then do another 1 to 3 years of something called a fellowship. And you can do that in multiple things. So, for example, I actually oddly started in surgery, switched to psychiatry, did a four-year psychiatry residency, then did a fellowship first in oncology, working in cancer, and then did a basic science fellowship to train. So lots of people do that. So when you go, for example, if you go and see an orthopedic surgeon who specializes in hand surgery, that's someone that has done the traditional 4 years of orthopedic surgery and probably done another 3 year specialty in just hand or spine. So it's a long process when you count college and medical school residency. The shortest residencies are 3 years, and that's medicine, family medicine, peds. The longest one is neurosurgery, which can be 7 to 9 years. And sometimes residencies include 2 years of required research, so it can be quite a long time. What follows that is what our students call real life. You actually then get to be a practicing physician. You're not done with tests at that point, though. You have to still obtain licensure in whatever state you're going to. There's actually 24 specialty boards that require you what you have to do. So, for example, in psychiatry, it's the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. And there are regular recertifications. So every 1 to 3 to 4 years, you have to take a test and or document that you've seen certain kinds of patients to maintain that specialty certification. The other thing that happens is outside of that specialty certification as a physician, you have to show that you've completed 25 hours a year of what's called continuing medical education, typically in the specialty you're going into, and that's how you maintain your license in the state. So once you start the testing process, you do it for the rest of your life, which is a good thing because that means you're getting physicians that have to be up to date on what the newest things are. Please. So the question is, what happens if someone changes states? So each state has its own licensing board. Some states have reciprocity so that you can, if you have, for example, California, it happens to be a one that is recognized by many other states. So moving from California to another state, you can get a I moved, for example, when I left here, I moved to Texas. Texas has reciprocity with California. What's interesting is California doesn't have reciprocity with many states. So you have to reapply. If it's been within the time that you've taken licensing boards, like a national exam, you reapply, they do a background check, you get it. If it's been too long, you may actually have to take another test that can cover up to all 4 years of medical school. So the question is, do you take it in the state where you want to practice or where you're doing residency? Unfortunately, you have to do both because you're covered by a training license during your intern year, but then you have to get a full state license where you're doing your residency. So, for example, I did my residency here in Los Angeles at UCLA in California and then went back to New York to do my first fellowship at Memorial Sloan Kettering. So I had to get a California license here, and when I went back to New York, I had to get a New York license. And then when I came back to California, I had to renew that. And so, it takes some time. To do that. So you have to actually prepare because you can't see patients until, and it can take 4 to 6 months once you start the process. You have to be sort of proactive in getting your license. Okay. So this is, you'll be hearing from Dr. Lucy later on in the series. This is sort of the goal at UCSF is to basically advance health worldwide, to foster a culture of discovery and innovation, and to solve important problems in healthcare today. And it used to be that solving important problems in healthcare was primarily medical, and it's still medical, but we think about molecular medicine, translational research, clinical, and translational means how do we take basic science research and bring it into actually patient care. Medical education is being addressed more and more, and how do we optimize clinical systems? You've heard a lot about that as in the national politics, is how do we maximize that? So I'm going to go through some of the different phases of getting into medical school. I'm going to move to admissions now and talking about what does it take if you're in college and you've made it through what you need to do, how do you get here? So, and this is our particular admissions policy at UCSF, but it's very similar to admissions policies around the country. We look for people that have pursued a wide range of undergraduate disciplines. It used to be that people believed you had to be a science major, a bio major, or a chemistry major. We actually take majors from the humanities and social sciences. The one caveat there is they still have to have done the pre-med requisites, and I'll show you those in a minute, the science courses. And we actually look for people that have shown an in-depth study around some passion. So we have people in our classes that were classical ballet dancers or that were music majors or political science majors. Now, they've had to take all the prerequisites, as I said, that I'll get to in a minute, but we really look for someone that's got passion and has shown scholarly activity coming here. So we take a wide variety of undergraduate majors. That having been said, still the vast majority of people are science majors. Another one that's actually been on the upswing over the last 10 to 15 years is engineers. We're having more engineer people that have been actually practicing, working engineers, coming back to medical school. We look at academic excellence, of course. We do, however, now look at that in the context of other factors. What courses did they study? Where did they study it? Obviously, a GPA from one college in biology is not the same as a GPA from another college, which means really sort of knowing what's going on at individual universities. We look at the individual background. Were they working during college? Were there other hurdles that they had to overcome? Did they show resilience? And it used to be that you had to sort of do the traditional lockstep things to get into medical school. We actually now look at people that have not done lockstep things, people that have done other jobs and decided to go back and take, you know, at age 35 or 40, the pre-med requirements and apply to medical school. So the average age of many medical schools has gone up from 24 to 7 up to some over 30 because of who's coming to medical school now. These are the courses we require here at UCSF. We strongly recommend but do not require a BA or a BS from college. We do have many, multiple students who have not done that, but we require 1 year of general chemistry with a laboratory, organic chemistry, which is the one that I talked to you about, minimum of two quarters of that. Physics, 1 year with laboratory. That's the one that every year, every two to three years, we think about, do we really need to require that, because it's an unusual, you don't really see a lot of physics in medical school. And then 1 year general biology with laboratory, and you're allowed to study vertebrate zoology, so it doesn't have to be human. But those are the required courses here, and those vary widely from medical school to medical school. The way medical schools are credentialed is something called the Liaison Committee of Medical LCME Education, and I actually do those site surveys to accredit medical schools, and I've been at a couple of medical schools that basically say they have no prerequisites. They just want you to do show that you have scholarly activity, that you can handle things. Now, what really happens is they really still want to see that you've done some biology, but they don't have strict requirements. These are ours. The other thing that we require is something called technical standards, and it used to be that these were pretty strict, and it's what kind of technical skills and abilities does someone have to become a practicing physician? So there are standard, and these are the non-academics, so this is beyond academics. You have to have powers of observation, because you have to be able to recognize what's going on with the patient. You have to be able to communicate, not only with patients to get a history and physical and to educate and get the patient to understand what's going on, but you have to communicate with other healthcare givers, other team members, and you have to have motor function because you have to do physical exams. Now, what's very interesting is with the American Disabilities Act, people are now allowed to use extenders, physician extenders, with these. So, for example, we don't have someone at this medical school right now, but there are people across the medical schools in the country that are blind that are going to medical school, and they have an extender that will do the exam and describe what's going on for them. We have people that are hearing impaired or deaf that are in medical school, and there are a variety of techniques that are used to get them through medical school. And motor function, there are actually people in medical school across the country that are not only paraplegic but quadriplegic, that are paralyzed. And people get very innovative in how they do that. But people are graduating with medical school with that. Now, obviously, their choice of a specialty will be determined by what they can and can't do. Someone that doesn't have upper arm motor function is not going to be a surgeon. So, the other technical standards are, we look at intellectual conceptual abilities. Do they have the ability to read and understand and manipulate information? Integrative and quantitative abilities. Can they integrate information and connect the dots across things? Behavioral and social attributes. Obviously, they need to be able to communicate people and care about people and understand cultural issues and gender issues and a variety of other things. And as I've already highlighted, ethical and legal standards are quite important. We recognize that physicians have access to a lot of very important and private information, and that's an important thing to think about. The selection factors that we look at here, as I said, we look at intellectual and personal characteristics. We looked at cognitive abilities, and that's primarily through the academic. How do people think? Are they capable of thinking? And at non-cognitive factors. And the way we get at non-cognitive factors is that we look at their personal statement. So everyone writes at least one, probably more than one. We ask for a general personal statement about why medicine. Many times we have what's called a secondary application, and I'll show that a little bit in a minute, where we ask further questions. For example, give us an example of a time where you had a failure and how you handled it. Give us an example of a difficult situation you've dealt with, just to get an idea of how they handle things. And we also look at extracurricular activities. What kinds of things did they do? One of the things that can be a misconception for undergrads is that they think medical schools want to see someone that's done 25 activities. We don't want to see that. What we want to see is someone that's done many fewer activities, 3 to 5 or whatever, but done them in depth and done them over time. We do look for people that have shown that they understand what they're getting into. So classically, people have done some sort of service or medical kind of work beforehand, but we don't require someone having done research or something like that, but we look at the depth of what they've done. We get about 8,000 applications a year here. I'm going to show you those numbers in a minute. And then we actually ask about 500 of those to come to interview. And we use the things I was just mentioning to determine how we go from 8,000 to 500. What we look at, you know, are they self-directed, lifelong learners capable of monitoring their own performance? Physicians have to monitor themselves and their colleagues. Are they good at identifying and addressing gaps in their own knowledge? How is their problem solving? That we get through some academic things, but also through some of the essays that we ask them to write. We also get some of this information from their letters of recommendation. Are they capable of generating and examining research questions or questions about patients? Can they review and synthesize scientific literature? Have we had an example, and not necessarily scientific literature, but can they review and synthesize vast amounts of information? And lastly, can they apply their knowledge to practice? It's great to have someone that can do well on exams, but you have to be able to think on your feet and practice that. And the last is critical self-reflection. Are they people that are willing to look at how they're doing? I mentioned holistic review. This is a process that looks at experiences, attributes, and academic metrics. Again, everyone understands the academic metrics, but let me talk a little bit about the others. So we really look at how will people contribute to the teaching and learning at the institution, how will they contribute to the practice of medicine, and we balance all of these kinds of things looking at that, trying to get a balanced class. We don't want a class that's going to be 160 researchers. In the same way, we don't want a class that's going to be 160 community leaders. We want a class that's going to produce what our community and our state needs. And that's why we look at these things. This is actually from the AAMC, and this is looking at experiences, attributes, and metrics. And if you look at the center circle, you can see that there's metrics, which is the classic academic things, GPA, grade trends. We actually allow people to have some problems adjusting to college and improving as they get better, as they get through it, and MCAT. And if you go to the next circle, it's attributes, and it's looking at some other things that are important that we hadn't looked at before. The caveat here is because of state laws, we cannot use some of these things for admissions. And we're not the only state that does that. So this is for the whole nation. We don't look at race, age, or sex in the state of California. But then you go out to experiences looking at what kinds of experiences have people had that they bring to medical school. That also helps inform us on how do they think about things, how do they problem solve, and how do they adjust to changes around them. So these are the admissions processes and stats. First one is American College Admissions Service application. That's pretty much standard across almost all medical schools except for the state of Texas, which has their own system. Here at UCSF, we get about 8,000. I believe the school in the country that gets the most is George Washington in D.C., and they get about 12 or 14,000 a year. They have slightly larger class. So we start with 8,000 applications. We send out secondary applications, so we screen them to look for some things, and we send out about 5,000 secondary applications. So that's the first cut, if you will. And then, that represents about 60% of the people that have applied. We interview 500, so now we're down to 6% of people that have applied. Keep in mind that our target is a class of 160 or so. We actually end up accepting about 200 people or 3% of the class because people shift around. We accept about 200 to get a class of 160 because people will go to New York or to Stanford or to other places depending on family and what they desire, as well as financial aid. We waitlist about 150 people in addition to the 200. We don't have to go through our entire waitlist, but that represents another 2% of the applicant pool. And ultimately, we matriculate 150 here. There's another 16 that are matriculated over at the Joint Medical Program at Berkeley. And so we ultimately end up accepting and matriculating 2% of the people that have applied here. Those are not great odds. Please. Yeah, so that's where we send out some of these other essays, asking for resilience, times that you've had failures. Give us an example of have there been any things that we need to know about that could have inhibited your success So were you working during school? And it's a chance for us to really get to know the person a little bit better. There's typically, depending on the school, between 3 to up to 9 kinds of essays or questions on that. So it's a really, it's a chance for us to see what else is going on. But yeah, so we go from 5,000 down to 500. We cut, you know, we cut out 90% of people. And I should say this, there's a, the admissions process here is very involved, obviously. We have people that do screeners, that are screeners. They start with the 8,000 and screen it down to the 5,000. Then we have screeners that screen from the 5,000 down to the 500. Then we have people that interview, and we do 2 interviews per applicant here, plus tours and everything. And then we get the results from the interview, and the selection committee narrows it down to the 200 plus the 150. So it's a very arduous process. Typically, schools, the total number of faculty, and we use students and community members for admissions, as many medical schools do, it's somewhere between 40 and 80 people are involved every year with that process because it's a lot of reading to do. Did that answer your question? Okay. I wanted to go over the cost because medical school is not cheap. So as you, these are go through year 1, year 2, year 3, and year 4. There's different times, different lengths. There's slightly different tuition and fees. But as you can see on the far right, and these are for in-state residents, basically medical school costs between $70,000 and $80,000 a year here. You'll notice at the bottom there's a non-resident supplemental tuition. So if you're not a state of California resident, you pay an additional $12,000 over the $70,000 to $80,000 that you pay. So if you're an out-of-state resident and you're going to medical school here and it's your third year, your tuition fees, cost of living, books, supplies, commuting is over $90,000 a year. So how do people pay for that? So this is looking at just the class of 2016, the average number amount of loans borrowed in medical school per student over the 4 years was about $140,000 total. And this does not include any undergrad or pre-med debt. So we have people graduating with excess of $300,000 debt. We have students that have debt from college, another advanced degree, and perhaps sometimes even prep school before college. The national average is $162,000, so we're actually below the national average for the amount of debt that our students graduate with. And roughly 85% of our students receive some sort of financial aid. It's a combination of loan and scholarship. We're fairly fortunate that we have pretty good endowment, particularly for a state institution. We're able to offer scholarships to people. There are other schools. So, for example, UCLA has David Geffen. It's now the David Geffen School. There are, I believe, 34 Geffen scholars in each of their classes that gets complete free ride for tuition fees and cost of living. Needless to say, that's one of the places we lose students to because we can't offer 34 people that here. So as I said, I'm going to go back now and talk a little bit about what medical school looks like. Again, not going into detail of what the individual days look like because you'll be hearing about that. But so this, I'm actually going to show you the slides that I show students when they enter. So I get to be part of orientation and welcome students when they start. So this is what is their life looking like over the next 4 years. There's a couple of rules that we sort of go over with them to help them understand is don't overcommit. These are young go-getter kinds of people that, you know, are now kids in a candy store. We have, I believe, close to 100 student groups that they can join. These are people that, to get into medical school, you know, were officers and were doing all sorts of things. So they come here and they think, this is like college. I will get to do all of these things. And the analogy that you will hear people talking about is there's actually nothing that's particularly hard in medical school necessarily. It's the volume. So it's you're drinking from a fire hose is the analogy, people. So the first thing is don't come here and sign up to be in 10 different student organizations and officers in 8 of those. It's not a sprint. We get students who have made it through college by studying at the last minute. You can't do that in medical school just because there's so much to know. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon. You can't just wait to the last minute. Balance, I'll talk a little bit more about that later, is being able to balance your external life with the demands of medical school, particularly in the third year, in the clinical year, because not only are you responsible for learning, but you're up on the wards then. And depending on the service, OBGYN and surgery, you may need to get there at 4:30 in the morning to pre-round on patients and not finish till 8 at night, 7 or 8 at night. So really helping students understand the balance, because burnout is a problem that they need to continue to re-energize. Typically, the first thing students do when they get stressed, I think it's what we do as human beings, is we start giving up the things that are stress relievers for us. We stop exercising, we stop eating well, we start studying too much. So we encourage them to re-energize, attend to self-care, make sure they're taking care of themselves, obviously study. You'd be surprised. You know, I think most people think that my job is getting people to study because they're not studying enough. That does happen. But my biggest job as the dean of students is you can't study 18 hours a day. And people will try to do that. The other thing is be yourself. There's a whole culture of medicine, and we continually remind people that you're here because we chose you as an individual, and continue to be an individual. Rest. And we also tell them that care packages from home are a real plus. The other thing that we tell our students is you will disappear around exams, and you need to make sure your family members understand that you're okay, but they can't call you for an hour every day, and really helping them understand how to set those kinds of limits. So what's the timeline? The new, and you'll be hearing about the years. It used to be that there was MS1, MS2, MS3, and MS4, with MS1 and 2 being the preclinical years, MS3 being the year where you're exposed to the clinical rotation, MS4 where you sort of hone your skills and pick your specialty. Our new curriculum has actually changed a little bit. So we have Foundations 1, which is what the F1 is. That in our new curriculum goes the first year and half of the second year. Then we go into Foundations 2, which is the clinical year, and we start that in January. So that's 6 months earlier than it used to be. That goes for a full year, and then we have something called Career Launch, which is the remaining part of the 4 years. So we've actually decreased the amount of preclinical time, quote, preclinical time, kept the amount of clinical time the same as far as the rotations, and I'll show you this in a minute, but really added more at the end for people to sort of gain sort of more specific skills and hone in on a specialty. So the classic thing is we ask them to orient, settle, and to pace yourselves. People come in and they're all gung-ho, and it's like you need to sort of relax a little and pace yourself. Learn. They go through the fall and learn how to do exams. And it's amazing. So our students have been here since the first year students since the end of August. They've now had two major exams, and there's that whole anxiety that happens before the exams. And by the time Thanksgiving rolls around, it's almost a little bit hard to tell when they have exams because they've gotten really sort of used to doing that. They then go home for a 2 to 3 week winter break. And our school is, like many schools now, has gone to when you finish before you go home for winter break, you're done. There's nothing you have to do. There are some schools that you still have to come back to exams in January, which, how's that a break? So people come back in January or spring of that, their first year, and can finish the rest of the courses for that year. That spring, they begin thinking about the last summer of their life. So the students have off the summer between first and second year, and then they don't really get a summer off again. She looks horrified. You can take vacations. It's just that it's not like summer. Because when you come back as a second year student here, you start in August, go through winter break, and then in January you start your year of clinical rotations. It goes January through December. That summer is gone. And then the next year, you're actually doing things to get into residency. So they call it their last summer of their life. It's sort of their last real, like, 8 to 10 week time period. We encourage people to think about what they're going to do during that time. Vacation, research, studying language, clinical experience, a mixture of those things, and then they do their summer. There are some residencies that you really need to do research for during that time to be competitive for the residents. They tend to be the competitive surgical subspecialties like orthopedic surgery, neurosurgery, ophthalmology, ear, nose, and throat, urology, dermatology is another one, and radiation oncology that are very research-based. You come back, as I said, for the second part of Foundations 1, which is just the fall of your second year here. Obviously, that we ask them to reorient, resettle, recalibrate, learn, and keep going. And they start their clerkships in January. So our current second-year class, they just got back here in August. They are finishing their coursework. We're now asking them to pick their clerkship schedule for the next year, which starts in January. That's when they go into Foundations 2, which is the clinical year. And this is the way we have that clinical year set up. You do rotations, and these are called the core clerkships. So you do 4 to 6 to 8 weeks in each of these. So, for example, you do 8 weeks of surgery, 6 weeks of OBGYN, 4 weeks of psychiatry, 6 weeks of pediatrics. I'll come back to family medicine, 8 weeks of internal medicine, 4 weeks of neurology, 2 weeks of anesthesia, and you have about 6 weeks of elective time in that third year. The reason I'm coming back to family medicine is 2 years ago, it used to be that family medicine was an six or eight week clerkship. One of the things about family medicine, which is primary care, is if you do something in 8 weeks, you're missing sort of the way family medicine typically works. And the strength of family medicine is people get to see patients over time. So you can't really see people over time in 8 weeks. So we went to a longitudinal family medicine clerkship where every other week for the entire year, the students are in a clinic, the same clinic, seeing the same patients for the whole year. So it's been a wonderful experience for our students as well as the patients because they get to see the same student over time. The student gets to see how illness process or health regaining process over time happens. So that's what we've been doing for about a year and a half now, 2 years. So that's what third year looks like. The electives we encourage, there's 3 2-week ones, people to explore other areas that they might be interested in doing in for a career. So you can do 2 weeks in urology or 2 weeks of radiology, pretty much 2 weeks of anything during that time period. What happens then is it's starting in the fall. While you're doing those rotations, you have to start thinking about your fourth year, which may or may not include away rotations. So when you're a fourth-year student and thinking about your residency, you may decide that you want to stay here for residency or you may decide you want to go all over the country. There are some specialties that are quite competitive. So, for example, again, the ones I mentioned, orthopedic surgery, derm, those kinds of things that classically, you apply to, if you're a solid student in internal medicine, you may apply to 20 residencies and keep them focused in California. If you're going into orthopedic surgery, you apply to 60 to 80 residencies spread out all over the country. And that's sort of what you have to do to be guaranteed you'll get a spot in residency. So typically, you may then do away rotations in those specialties to sort of endear yourself to another region of the country or another program, as well as to find out if you are willing to move there. I grew up in northern Maine, which is why I live in California now. And the interesting thing is that the number of our students who are, want to go back east or to the Midwest, I always ask, have you like lived in snow? Because it'll be 3 to 5 to 7 years of being in snow. And they always say, well, I've been to Tahoe. And it's like, that doesn't count as living in snow. So I encourage people that are thinking about that to do an away rotation in November or December in Chicago, because you may not decide that you want to go there. That then moves into the next year, which is career launch. It's been traditionally, as I said, it was called the fourth year before. It was 1 year. It's now a little bit longer. That winter, when you come back, winter into spring, there are a series of licensing exams, a United States medical licensing exam. And there's actually three parts. There's step one, step two, and step three. The first two parts you have to take in medical school. And step three you take during your first year of residency / internship. And these are licensing exams. And they're accepted, and not only accepted, but they're required to obtain a medical license in all 50 states. Step one classically covers the basic sciences with a clinical bent. And it covers the first year and a half for us. Step two, CK stands for clinical knowledge. It covers clinical knowledge. So it's basically all the material you've learned during your clinical year, hypertension, peds, all sorts of things. And those, both of those exams are 8-hour exams. There's 6 to 7 modules of 40 to 60 questions each, and you take breaks and you get your exam score. That you actually get a score there. The, even though these are licensing exams, many residencies use these as a way to compare students across, within the same school, but across schools. Because program directors, there's about 9,000 residency programs in our country, need a way to sort of compare students from school A to school B. And so they will use step one. So it's a very, very high stakes exam for students, because it can actually literally determine if you will be a neurosurgeon or not. Because if the score is too low, programs won't look at you. When a program gets an application, and I'll go over how that happens, they can actually do screens. So if I'm a program director in psychiatry, I can screen it out. So even though I've gotten 4,000 applications, if I say I want a step one score of X, I won't even see the ones that are below that. And step one is probably the biggest screen that people use. Step 2CS stands for clinical skills. That one is pass-fail. And what that is actually 10 clinical stations. And you have to fly. You can take the first two ones at any Prometrics, which are, there's many of them in every city. The clinical skills one, there's only 5 places you can take it in the United States because it's set up to do that. And it looks like a clinic, and you have 10 stations where you go and you have to introduce yourself to the patient, and you are evaluated on your interaction with the patient. Did you wash your hands? Did you introduce yourself? Did you do an appropriate physical exam? These are mock patients, but they will tell you what, you know, you're examining my heart, this is what you hear, and then you have to write a note afterwards. And that's a part of what has to happen. The failure rate on these, actually, the step one has the highest failure rate, and step 2CK slightly lower, step 2CS slightly lower, and step 3, which is the one that you take during internship, is the lowest. But the failure rate for step one is probably around 7%, I think, now. Then after you have taken those, and under our new curriculum, you take all 3 of those during your career launch after you've done your rotations. You spend the spring or summer doing rotations. And the way to think about the last year of medical school is you are really using the first part of that to fine-tune your specialty choice. You may have already made your specialty choice if it's something that you've rotated through in third year, like internal medicine or peds or psychiatry, but they don't do emergency medicine. They don't do radiology. So people will use the first part of that last year to determine what specialty you're going to go into. The next part of that early fall is to do what's called a sub-internship, where you act like an intern as a medical student, and that actually tells programs, based on your evaluation there, how likely you're able to be, how much you are able to jump into being an intern. And that's what you may do. You typically do one at your home school. You may do one at other places in the country. And so you really then are focusing on doing rotations that get you into your specialty of choice. And then you start interviewing for residencies. So there's something called the ARIS application, and it's a unified application that almost all residencies use. There's a couple that don't, specialties that don't. And it is due by September 5th of every year. And it basically includes a CV that each student fills out, as well as a personal statement, which is tailored to their specialty. Some specialties, like ear, nose, and throat, require that you write a separate paragraph for each one of the programs you're going to about why that program. There's gotten to be some other very innovative ways of looking at this. Emergency medicine this past year required their people to do an online interview that was videotaped, recorded, was evaluated by a group of people that have been trained to do that, and they're scored on that, and then that score goes to the residency program. They also have the ability to look at the videotapes. This was the first year that was done. So there's some very interesting ways of how programs are looking. And keep in mind that while we go from 8,000 to 150, it's not uncommon for a residency that has, you know, an emergency medicine that has 12 to 16 spots, they could have 3,000 applications. And they don't have a cast of 60 to 80 people doing it. They have 3 to 5 people doing that, more people interviewing, but making the choices. The rest of that application is something called the Dean's Letter. It's no longer called the Dean's Letter. It's called the MSPE, Medical Students Performance Evaluation, and it's a summary statement written by the school on every single student about how they've done in the first, at this point, 3 to 3.5 years. That comes out October 1st. As I said, they write a personal statement, and then they get letters of recommendation. Each residency will take up to 4 letters of recommendation. Classically, you pick it in your specialty. If you're going into surgery, of the 4, 3 of them need to be surgery. If you're going into family medicine, 1 or 2 of them need to be family medicine, because family medicine includes everything else. You can get letters from psych and peds and a variety of other things. Interviews then happen from October to January, and we recommend the number of interviews we recommend on as a minimum is 10 to 12. So this is quite costly, particularly if you're flying around the country doing that. And as I said, there are some specialties that people really need to do upwards of 20 to 30 interviews. So they fly all over the country doing that. And then what happens the third week of February, when everything's done, I, as a student, if I've interviewed at 17 places, I will rank those places 1 through 17 and log that into the computer. So number 1 is I want to be in Chicago. Number 2, I want to be in New York. Number 3, programs do the same thing. They will, I'm a program in ear, nose, and throat. I want, you know, Jackie is my number 1 on down to, I've got 4 spots. I may rank 80 people. Some programs, like our internal medicine internship residency, take 60 to 80 people per year. So they may rank 200 to 300 people. What happens then is that all goes into the match computer. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. Then what happens is the third Friday in March is match day. That's when all 25,000 or so students across the country get the envelope at the same time and tear it open and open that up. I have to say it's a particularly stressful day for people. And it's interesting because we have a nice celebration, and then we allow people to get their envelopes and we do a countdown. Every school does it this way. And then if people want to come up and say where they're going. So I'm standing up there with the other deans, and you're watching people. And we actually know before they do. We found out the day before they're doing where they're going. And I've learned as the student affairs dean a few years ago. I've been student affairs dean at a couple of different schools now. Someone came up to me afterwards, and they got their first choice, and they said, "I was so sure I didn't get my first choice because I saw you in the hall, and they knew I had seen it, and you gave me a funny look, and it was like I had gas. My stomach was bothering me. The day before this comes up, I hide in my office because I don't want to torture anybody, making them think that I know. The other thing that's a caveat about that is we've had people, they burst into tears. And as I said, I'm an emergency room psychiatrist. I can't tell if they're happy or really upset. So we have a rule that if someone goes running out of the room, we follow them, because happy people typically don't go running out of the room. But it's a very, very stressful day. And then they graduate in May. They then go on to internship/residency. As I said, they typically start in June to the beginning of July. It's 3 to 9 years. They then go on to board certification. I mentioned fellowships. They can then go on to do specialty fellowships, and then they go on to practice and attending. I want to say something about the match. I've already mentioned match day. We really want students to hone in on what they're going to go into. So we have a rule here called the 3-2-1. Again, keeping in mind they have to get their applications in September 15th. We ask students to narrow it down to 3 by April, 2 by May, and 1 by June. About 10 years ago, if you'd asked me, you know, typically in June, some people that have narrowed it down to 3, and I used to be really upset about that. Something happens between then and September 15th where almost everyone's narrowed it down to 1. So I've learned not to be quite so upset. I want to say something quickly about couples matching. So there is the ability for people to enter the match together so that you can guarantee that you match with your husband, wife, spouse, best friend, brother, sister, whomever. And it's a little bit more complicated, but there is a way for people to guarantee that they will be together for their residency for the most part. A few years ago when I was at Davis, I held that year the record for the number of people that were couples matching, and it was 10 couples match, which is very complicated. So, and because there are 2 people applying, and you have to put into your match request list all the possible combinations. If 2 people have interviewed each at 20 places, that's 400 possible slots they can put in. They don't tend to put all those in, but the norm is somewhere between 80 and 130 slots on their rank list if you're couples matching. This is the match rate by specialty. And as you can see, that it varies widely, but there are some that are as low as 70%. So that means 30% of people that apply in that specialty do not match. That tends to be the competitive ones, urology, ENT. If you see dermatology, is quite low. So those are people that have applied in their field and have not matched in that field. So roughly a third of people that apply in urology don't match. What happens to those people? I would just go over the mean number of ranks that people have put in. So the number in dark blue is the number that tells you that, in, so for example, the highest one is 16. The average number of programs that someone ranked that matched was 16. The average number for that specialty of people that didn't match was 11. So the more programs that you have ranked, the more likely you are to match, which is why we see people going with 60, 70 places. Let me talk a little bit about what our match rate is here. So in 2017, we had 152 people graduating from our class. And you might say, wait, we start off with 150, added 16, what happened? People go off, and as I said, it takes them 5 years to graduate. And this past year, we've had it as high as 180, 190, I believe, here. Plus, we had 10 previous graduates who had gone into either do research or had gone into another specialty and decided to change. Of those people, we had 10 people who originally did not match. There's a process called Supplemental Offer and Acceptance Program that we were able to find everyone a match through that. So we were actually able to match everybody ultimately by the end of the week there. Of the people that matched by the end of the week, 68% of them stayed in California. 36% stayed at UCSF. That's almost twice the national average. If you look at most medical schools in the country, roughly 15 to 18% of people will stay at that institution. So this is unusually high. 53% of our students went into primary care, and that's just defined nationally as family medicine, internal medicine, and pediatrics. This is a bigger breakdown of where people went. As you see, 36% of people stayed at UCSF, 68% only stayed in California, another 9% stayed on the West Coast, 9% went to the Midwest. Then we break it down by some of the bigger states in the East Coast. New York has a lot of programs. It's the city that has the most residencies in the country, and about 7% went to the South. Are the specialties. These are the order of the largest number of people that went into them, but the top four were family and community medicine, internal medicine, peds, and emergency medicine. And here's the breakdown of that class of 2017, who went into what. So you can see there's quite a spread there, but it's not uncommon to see one or two people going into urology. We've had actually a year or occasionally where no one goes into neurosurgery, neurological surgery. So this is the breakdown of what people do. As I said, you then go on to residency and fellowship. And I've already talked about that, to real life, the recertification, and we've talked about that. I just want to quickly go over what the challenges have been for students over the 4 years. They come in and hopefully maintain a great deal of excitement. They come in with a lot of fears. One of the things I say to students their first day of medical school, I'm like, who here is anxious? And raise their hands. And I'm like, who here is not anxious? And whoever raises their hand, it's like, you need to come see me as a psychiatrist because you should be anxious. This is a nerve-wracking thing. There's a lot of unknowns. People come in with ideas of what medical school is going to be like, and they typically get it right. But what I think is a struggle for people or challenging for people is seeing people in the clinical years that are in situations that you could not possibly have imagined. At both extremes, people that are living in situations that you can't understand how someone's survived that, and other times at the other end of the spectrum, seeing amazing resilience and caring from people. And so it's quite an emotional thing for people. People undergo through a lot of growth. Their knowledge is amazing. We had a student when I was left here in 99 to go be the student affairs dean in San Antonio. The class size there is 230. But we had a student there that lived in the same condo her entire 4 years, and her graduation card I thought was particularly funny. She was 5'6", And she took all the syllabi and books that she had read over the 4 years and piled it up on the wall going this way and that way. And the books were, she superimposed a picture of herself laying down in front of it and standing in front of it. And the books and both of those were bigger than her. So, and her card was like, I've actually read everything in all of this at least 3 to 5 times, which is pretty amazing. So the knowledge is amazing. A lot of professional growth. We take people that are, you know, college seniors or have been out working, and they become physicians where they have to really understand a code of ethics and privacy. And there's a lot of personal growth. As I said, people see things that they didn't know even existed, and problems that people go through. We want people to thrive here, so we have a variety of supports. My team is called the Student Experience Team, and our whole job is to take care of students and make sure that they have the resources that they need, that they have the advising that they need. We have medical student well-being. We actually hire a psychologist and a psychiatrist 3/4 time to take care of only medical students. It's anonymous, and I don't know who they're seeing, and it's free. We also have student health on campus that in addition to having more therapists and psychiatrists, also covers all the medical needs. Career advising, helping people, and that starts with the first year. How do you know how to pick a career? We have a learning specialist to help people understand how to take exams and how to study for things. Student disability services. So we have people that have learning disabilities or other kinds of accommodations that they need, and we do those. There's a lot of campus support services that are between all the schools here. Financial aid's a big one. As well as the registrar. And the registrar is the person that you rely on later in your life, because every time you go to a new hospital and need to be credentialed, you need something from the registrar of your medical school, or if you go from state to state. We really focus on balancing school with their life. The attitude of I'm just going to put my life aside for the 4 years I'm in medical school doesn't work, because then you come back to your life at the end of the 4 years and it's not there. And I just wanted to finish with Catherine Lucy's quote. At UCSF, our mission is to advance health worldwide, and we are attracting some of the nation's best and brightest students to help to achieve that goal. One of the reasons our students come to UCSF is to work in a culture of discovery and innovation. They work closely with a wonderful community of faculty and help them solve important problems in healthcare today in areas such as molecular medicine, clinical and translational research, medical education, scholarship, and optimizing clinical care delivery. And I do have to say our students are really amazing. It makes me feel good that I'll be taken good care of. So that's all I wanted to say. I wanted to open up for discussion and questions. So the question, just to repeat it for the tape, is how do they afford the debt that they graduate with? And it's interesting. So most of the loans that students have will have a three-year hiatus allowing for residency. So when someone finishes medical school and goes on to residency, they typically don't have to start paying back on their loans. Interns here in the state of California start off at about $50,000 to $60,000 a year. That goes up a little bit each year. And actually, when you're doing a fellowship, that tends to be part of the residency hierarchy. So you maybe get up into $70,000 a year. There's a variety of payment options for students. The more popular ones are based on your income level. So it gets adjusted what you have to pay depending on how much you're making. But as you can imagine, that also means it could change the length of what you have to pay. The other thing that's available for students is that you can have a payback where if you go and work in an under-physicianed area part of your state or the country, they will forgive X amount of your loans. So it's not uncommon to see someone to go to a part of the state or part of the country where they need physicians and work for 4 to 6 years, and that pays the state or the federal government, depending on who's covering that area, will pay back your loan. But most people will be paying back on their loans for 20-plus years for that kind of debt. So the question is interest. It depends on the loan, but yes, it is for some of them. So students, what frequently is recommended by people is that they at least pay the interest during that time period, because that's manageable during that. The other thing that living on $50,000 in San Francisco can be quite hard. But as residents, particularly as interns, they don't have time to do anything else. So it's not like they're out there spending a lot of money. So the question is all the innovations, particularly around some of the facilities and Mission Bay. So, yeah, there's a lot going on here. fair amount of it when you are along Parnassus is earthquake retrofit, when you see the buildings out there. But yeah, the students get a lot of exposure. So if you go across the street to our library, there's something called the Canbar Center. For example, that's our simulation center. And it's set up to look like a doctor's office. There are rooms that also will look like a surgical operating room. And we actually run our students through there with simulated patients. So there's a lot of facilities here that students use. We actually use multiple sites because we don't have enough of anything here to cover that. And you may or may not know that we have moved some of our core healthcare delivery systems to Mission Bay. So, for example, PEDS and OBGYN are down there. That's where the majority of that care is given. And I think OBGYN is a particularly great example because we have upwards of 10 sites spread out around the city and the East Bay and North Bay and South Bay where students can do their 6 weeks of OB. So they get out and about a lot. So there's a lot going on at Mission Bay. The good news is we have this phenomenal shuttle system that runs. And so we send people to the VA. But Mission Bay and ultimately psychiatry will be moving there for both their outpatient and inpatient just because it's easier to build a new building that meets earthquake standards than to try to take one down and build it on the same campus. So students, yeah, they get to go through a lot to a lot of things. We are continually upgrading our lecture halls, and you know, we had to really upgrade to be able to handle Wi-Fi for phones and computers and things like that. So, and it's interesting because, and this is my personal opinion, is when you look at what can give you the best training, there are multiple kinds of hospitals, and we're one of the few medical schools in the country that have all of those. So we have a county hospital, San Francisco General. We have a tertiary, quaternary care university hospital here. We have a veterans hospital, VA, and most places do not have, UCLA does not have all three of those. So I guess I probably shouldn't be bashing UCLA. I did my residency there. They're a wonderful school. Let me go on tape of saying that. But you're right. I think we offer a particularly good education. And, you know, Stanford and UC Davis are the only other players in Northern California, and they're 35 and whatever, however far, miles away. And we really have great partnerships with Kaiser and Sutter and a variety of other places. So our students get to do, we send a fair amount of students down to Fresno. We've had a campus down there for 20 plus years, so we send students down there. So I couldn't agree. That's why I wanted to come back here. So,
Do they ever drop out?
That's a really good question. Yes, they do. So every year we have to report to AAMC, that kind of thing. And every 8 years we go through a reaccreditation. Ours is coming up in January, February of 2019. We have to fill that all out. The nationally accepted number is 4%. We're actually significantly lower than that. I've been here just a year, and we've had two people drop out since I've been here, and it's been really interesting. This has been my experience at other schools when this has happened, and I've been there longer, is they drop out either because there's something going on personally, that this is just not the right time of their life, or they've decided they want to be an architect or something else, and they leave. So there are people that sometimes drop out for academic reasons. They get, I guess that's not so much dropping. We allow people to drop out before they're dismissed sometimes. So, because not everyone can do this. We know that everyone can do it from a, when we accept them from a, can they do the rigor, but there may be other things going on in their lives that prevent them from being able to finish. So the question is, do they make more money across, based on the prestige of the medical school? So that's an interesting question. I think it's easier to get into better, whatever that means, residencies from bigger name medical schools or well-renowned medical schools. So we're fortunate in that UCSF is considered one of the best medical schools, not only in the country, but in the world. So our students can do very well with a match. So we will send people probably more than some other schools to the higher paying specialties. So what really determines how much money someone makes as a physician is what their specialty is. And if you look at average incomes across specialties, the procedural ones are the highest. So orthopedic surgery, urology, neurosurgery, and it's as well as sometimes radiology and dermatology. And so it tends to be more by specialty. So I guess indirectly, because it's perhaps easier for students to come from a bigger name, more prestigious school to get into those residencies and those fellowships. And the other thing is we also have more. We have 1,400 residents and fellows here. So we produce more people in those fields that go on to make a fair amount of money. Right. So the question is about physician shortage and the numbers. That's a very interesting question. And I do a lot of work at AAMC, so we look at this all the time. And what's interesting is every year at match time, and nationally, there's about 1,000 U.S. seniors who haven't matched. At the end of the supplemental offer and acceptance program, there's still 300 to 400 that still don't have a place. And so we find the master's position. And so these are people that have this debt and haven't matched. What's interesting is it's not just the graduates of our medical schools that have access to the match. So people coming from not only offshore but around the world come in, and increasingly programs may take someone from an international school, and they may be U.S. citizens that are international graduates from another school, or they may be non-U.S. citizens coming from their home country, and they can have very high Step 1 scores. And so those people will get positions that some people would say could have gone to our graduates. The osteopathic schools are also producing large numbers of people, and they can go into our residencies. So what's interesting is if you look and see, are there enough slots in residency for all of our U.S. graduates to have slots? Absolutely. But it's not necessarily in the specialties they want to go into. So there's a disconnect between what's available and what specialty. There tends to be more primary care. One-year surgery is another slot that there's a lot of, and people don't want to do that. The interesting thing is if you think about the numbers of people, we've actually increased the medical schools. When I went to medical school, I'm not even sure there were 100 medical schools in the country. I can remember a few years ago when there were 100 in it was like in the low 130s, 120s. We're now up to 146. So there's been many, many more medical schools opening. And the other thing to address this, and the other thing that's happened is, I don't remember how long ago, but the University of Texas, all five of their UT medical schools went from 100 per class to over 200 to 250 per class. So there's really been a push on medical schools. The AAMC put out a challenge 12 or 15 years ago to head off this shortage by increasing the number of medical graduates. And here's where the problem is. So we have increased numbers of people graduating, which state legislatures and boards, for example, of private schools like Stanford, can change the numbers or open new medical schools. The actual residency slots are controlled by the federal government. It's Medicare. And so those slots have not been increasing. They've increased a little bit, but not a whole lot. So, and the other thing that's happening is if you look at where the shortage areas are, they tend to be in specialties that people aren't going into as much. So primary care. Some would say that that's because of the pay scale. A primary care physician working more hours can make significantly less than someone with a procedural specialty. So there's a lot of things that contribute to that. The other thing that if you look at the shortage, it's also very geographic. Cities, particularly wealthy parts of cities, have a excess of physicians per population. And then you go, if you look at the 10 counties that have the lowest physician to population ratio, I think four of them are in South Texas. But the good news is they just opened up a medical school there to address that. For us in California, it's the Central Valley, which is why UCSF has been committed to a campus in Fresno and really sending students down there and bringing students from there because that's who goes back there. People tend to go home. So it's a complicated question, but there even now when you look at some of the specialties that have not been listed as shortage, they're now starting to – we're having concerns that 10, 15, 20 years from now, there will be a shortage of them. Because the other thing is to keep in mind that baby boomers we're retiring. And many specialties, their specialty boards control how many people go into it. And there's several specialties that the number of people, residency slots in the country matches the number of people retiring and dying every year in that. So there's specialties that are not growing. as the but our population is growing. So, right? No, no, no. Those are all great questions. And rather than repeat the question, because I think what you're basically asking is how do osteopathic schools differ and how are they the same? And I can answer. And you actually hit all the points that I would address. So this is a perfect question. So there are more slots. They tend to be larger schools. And perhaps the way I can best illustrate how they're the same, so they actually have different matches. There's an osteopathic match, and then there is our allopathic match. Graduates of osteopathic schools have been allowed to enter our match. The reverse has not been true. And within osteopathic residencies, yes, they have many primary care, but they have neurosurgery osteopathic residencies and orthopedic surgery. They have very specialized residencies as well. What's different, what's changing now is we're actually merging those two systems. So by 2020 was the deadline. It's actually happening much more quickly than that. Our students will be able to start to apply to their programs, and we're merging into a single match process. In order for our students to go, so for allopathic MD students to go to an osteopathic residency, they're actually probably going to have to take about a 200-hour certificate course, because what perhaps one of the biggest differences is that osteopathy does a more holistic approach to things, and so that if you graduate from MD school to do that, you have to actually be brought up to speed on some of the homeopathy and some of the other alternative medicine that they do that we don't teach in our school. Now, the other thing I can tell you is that while there aren't a lot of people that are DOs at a place like UCSF, I suspect that almost all the specialties have someone who's a DO there. So they are able to go to residencies just like the rest of us and get academic positions and practice the same way we do in across the board of specialties. So I have colleagues in OBGYN and emergency medicine and surgery who are DOs and psychiatry across all specialties.
And what about their acceptance rates in terms of
getting into their med? Yeah. So it's interesting because their class size, they're opening up all over, and their class sizes can be over 300. So, for example, I used to live in Tucson, and Phoenix had, I believe, three osteopathic medical schools, and the class sizes were 300, 280, 250, or something like that. So very frequently, a common question I get from colleagues, children, or mentees is I'm going to apply to both, and I've had multiple times where people have gotten to osteopathic school and they're waiting for medical school, and it's like, which do I do? So I it's not that it's easy to get into osteopathy school, but it's probably more people get into that than get into US-based MD schools, allopathic schools. So the question was how with 300 students. So first of all, there are schools in the United States that have that Drexel, I believe, in Philadelphia has 320 per class. And their schools, just the osteopathic schools, just like our schools, have to go through a really stringent accreditation process. And you have to show that you have enough of everything for adequate teaching. The logjam tends to be at clinical sites because you can build larger lecture halls. Although in the first 2 years, the difficulty typically is around anatomy, gross anatomy, because you can't put 10 people around a table doing gross anatomy because they won't see. But it tends to be on clinical sites. Are there enough clinical sites? So schools have gotten very creative. So for example, I went to Dartmouth undergrad. The medical school there actually sends people to CPMC here for their third year, because there aren't enough sites in New Hampshire for them to do that. Creighton in Indiana actually sends people to Phoenix for their third year. Not all of them, but some of them. So that schools are already struggling for sites and having to do that. So they're not alone in doing that. But yeah, they if you graduated from a U.S. accredited DO school, they've had standards that they have to meet as far as education. And I don't know off the top of my head the number of DO graduates. I do know that every year in the match, about 50,000 people enter the match. Ultimately, I think that number drops down to 35,000 ultimately rank programs. And of those, about 25,000 are U.S. grads. So there's at least 10 to 12 to 15,000 people outside of U.S. grads that are U.S. seniors that are entering the match. And the number, as I mentioned, the number of DO schools in the United States is growing, and their class sizes are growing, as are ours.
Are they much more expensive?
So the question, yes, they are. They tend to be more expensive, and with a larger class size, yeah. And the other thing I should say is that the other place that our U.S. citizens go is the offshore ones in the Caribbean. And some those can be widely variable, but several of those schools actually start classes both in the fall and in January. So they've got a lot going on. And several of those schools are actually sort of a pyramid program where they will start off with X amount of people in the fall, but a third of them or half of them are graduating 4 years later. They don't have the 4% that or less than we have. So the question is, how do we use these things? So this was actually rolled out several years ago by AAMC as the holistic approach. And I had the good fortune of being able to be someone that with them went around and trained admissions committees around the country on this. And so this whole process is actually very mission driven. So the school has to sit back and decide what do they want their graduates to do? Because obviously if you want your graduates to be PhD kinds of researchers, that's different than if you're a new school in the upper peninsula of Michigan and you want to populate that area with primary care physicians. So we ask that schools look at what are they looking for, and that'll help determine what attributes and experiences you're looking for. When it comes to metrics, what we actually ask schools to do is, you know, to stop and figure out what's the floor of what somebody needs at your school to be successful. So, you know, the MCAT score, and I'll use the old MCAT just because we have the new MCAT's only 3 years old now. The scores were from 0 to 40, 45. And most places say that if you get 32 or 35 or 36, that's what you need to be successful. It turns out if you go back and look nationally, a score somewhere between 24 and 25 has the same 5 years graduation rate as someone that's got a 40. So part of what this does is the inner circle, we're looking at what are the metrics that you need to guarantee success at that particular school, and then based on what your mission is, what other attributes might you want to go after. And the other thing is, remember I said almost all of us want diverse classes, so we want people that are going into service, people going to primary care, and so we may look at a mixture of what we want. Again, we may want all of our people to have had some life experience and that's definitive or shows passion, but so we look at those three tiers differently. There's really the metrics is what does someone need to be successful, and then once they meet that, what are the other attributes and experiences that one would want to meet what your defined missions are for your school. If you Google AAMC holistic review, you can get this. There's a whole pamphlet on the website. And I've just gotten the it's time to stop time, because apparently if we don't get you out in time, the courtyard automatically locks and we'll be trapped here all night. Thank you for coming, and enjoy.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.